Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Robert Fuller. I'm your host for the brand new What is Happening at Columbia School of Social Work podcast. I'd like to welcome you to our inaugural episode. Each month, we'll be chatting with key voices in our profession who are dedicating their lives to the welfare of communities around the world. And today, I have the distinct pleasure of welcoming Dr. Melissa Begg to the podcast. Melissa is the Dean of the Columbia School of Social Work and Professor of Social Work and Biostatistics. She served as Vice Provost for Academic Programs for Columbia University from 2014 to 2019, and as Co-Director of the Irving Institute for Clinical and Translational Research from 2007 to 2018. Dr. Begg is a population health scientist with 30 years of experience and commitment to developing the strongest possible evidence base for human health and well-being. In 2006, Dr. Begg received both the University-Wide Presidential Award for Outstanding Teaching and the Mailman School Teaching Award from the graduating class itself. In 2012, she was elected a Fellow of the American Statistical Association and received the Lagacos Distinguished Alumni Award in Biostatistics from the Harvard School of Public Health. She also received the 2013 ASPPH Pfizer Award for Teaching Excellence. For more information on Dr. Begg, check out the show notes for this episode. I'm looking forward to the discussion. Melissa, Dr. Begg, so good to have you on this podcast.
Great to see you, Bob. It's been a while.
It has been a while. I think it's really important for our listeners to know something about you. I met you first as a professor of biostatistics at the Mailman School of Public Health. Yeah. You've come a long way since then. Here you are, the dean of the first school of social work in the United States. Right. That's quite a distance to have traveled. Tell us something about your past and how this connects to what you're doing right now.
Yeah, we share a lot of history here, Dr. Fuller-Love. So pleasure to be with you. Yeah, I am now in my 35th year at this university. I think you're the same. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And I've had the honor of serving in many different roles throughout a very long period. And I'm really happy to say that I finally found my home here in social work about 5 years ago. Like you, I started my career in public health, and I think I was attracted to both public health and social work because of those shared social justice roots that both disciplines pursue. And I think that with my training in biostatistics, I got to go out there and use data as a tool for social justice, as a way to affect policy change, to persuade people to things that we know will be better, that will improve health and well-being. It's nice to be here in social work, as I think of the similarities and differences between public health and social work. Public health is always working at the 30,000-foot level. Social workers have a unique advantage in that they work on the ground with individuals and families to see the impact of policies and environment on well-being, and to also work at that 30,000-foot level in collaboration with public health professionals and others to make change that we need.
I am very fascinated by that connection, I have to admit. Part of it is because here at the Mailman School of Public Health, our largest dual degree program is the one that accords the MPH as well as the MSW. I am very curious, as an educator, what do you think about that blend, about the different approaches that the two schools take? I think that represents a real challenge for most institutions that are engaged in training. What do you think about that?
So it's interesting you point that out. I think I've read somewhere that nationally, the largest dual degree program of social work might be law. But like you in this public health school, we here at Columbia in social work, this is our largest dual degree program as well. And I think it makes a lot of sense for the same reasons I just described to you a minute ago. Both have attracted me. I think you've dabbled a bit too. You have a joint appointment here with us in social work, I'm proud to say. And I think that public health and social work professionals are very natural allies and partners. It's a great collaborative engagement and one that we should build on.
I agree. I am now in my own courses, both here at Mailman at Teachers College and at Fishkill State Correctional Facility, where I am teaching as part of the Barred Prison Initiative.
Yeah,
really fascinated about the future, especially now that we are recovering from the ravages of COVID-19. Yeah. I am very impressed with how much the nation is going through what I describe as COVID, or should we describe it, amnesia. Folks have forgotten what it was like 2-3 years ago. And in fact, So many people are busily engaged in trying to forget that it even happened. The hopes that many of us had that the pandemic would be a way for us to really rethink what we do and how we do it, I have not seen that. I think people are so busy trying to get away that it's hard to take any serious lessons from what we suffered over the course of the period from 2020 until today. I'm curious about your reactions to that, because there was a time when looking at pandemics was part of what you were doing as a biostatistician.
Absolutely, yeah, and even dabbling and teaching a little epidemic modeling along the way. But that's a fascinating observation, this notion of COVID amnesia. Bob, so I think when we were in the heat of COVID, particularly right at the start, I felt, and I think many people felt, this sense that we're all in this together. And I think it really underscored the fact that mutual reliance is at the core of our existence. And that changed over time, for sure. As I think about this term, COVID amnesia, what do I think? We're still living with so much impact from COVID-19 and from other pandemics of anti-Black racism, anti-Asian hate, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, transphobia, homophobia, all of that is still with us. So why the pushing away? Why the amnesia? I know people want to move on, yet we're making a mistake if we don't take lessons from this period. Interreliance was crucial to managing COVID, recognizing how we all impact each other, how we can all support each other or not. As you well know, based on your work, the mental health care needs in this country are enormous. They were before COVID. And some estimate that of those suffering from mental health disorders, only about half got access to treatment prior to the COVID pandemic. We know that the isolation and the damage and the grief from COVID has dramatically increased mental health care needs without a proportionate increase in the number of providers. If we could only serve half the population before, where are we now and how are we going to fill that gap? I think we have to fight against this COVID amnesia, really take a clear-eyed look at what that impact is and figure out where we need to invest resources to address it. Social workers are the largest group of mental health care providers in the country. They can fill a lot of the gap. And so how do we push that forward and make that a priority for the nation? I think that's a challenge for us.
I would agree. I think that both public health and social work really suffer from image problems. I think when you ask people, so what is social work? You get the same sort of issues. And I think the idea that we do the work, we have the theories, we have the concepts, and we want to train students in our classrooms to really understand. Mm-hmm. But the idea that we almost feel as if we're just talking to each other, that we haven't figured out how to talk to the general public, is certainly an issue in public health. I think the perception up here is we really blew it when it came to effectively communicating with the public what needed to be done in the midst of a pandemic. And I think that social work is suffering from the same kind of issues of what do you teach, how do you teach it, and how is it relevant for something like a pandemic? What do you think when people ask you that question? So what do you do and why is this important?
Well, let me start with this. I could not agree more. I think that public health and social work do suffer from an image problem. I like the way you phrased that. I think that the COVID pandemic helped public health a little bit, although there were communications issues there too. But it gave the public a better sense of what public health is all about. Social work faces a very similar problem. Most people have a very narrow view of what social work is. They have no appreciation that social work, you'll find social workers in every industry at every level. I think that's because they're good communicators and they're trained to build on human relationship to effect change. There's a beautiful thing about social workers. They're extremely humble. They don't want to tell their story of what they do, but you will find social workers everywhere, whether it's in schools, hospitals, addiction clinics, community-based organizations, social service agencies, even government offices, HR offices. Social workers work in many different ways to support their communities. We need to tell that story better. And I think that I've been in conversation with deans of other schools of social work, and we share this goal. How do we tell that story better so that people really appreciate the wide variety of things that social workers do? So that's the practice side. On the research side, you will find social workers addressing the thorniest issues we face as a society. mental health and being, treating addiction, racism and resilience, poverty and economic mobility, the effects of tech on society and well-being. These are things in the newspaper every day. I don't think people realize that social workers are working on the gamut of those issues. And it's all to achieve the purpose of maximizing human well-being and ensuring that everybody can reach their full potential. So I think we have that challenge on the communication side, on the storytelling side, if you will. And I think we also need to promote social work education and what that means. There were questions raised in a recent op-ed in the New York Times about the nature of social work education and how we deliver it. We are here to deliver an excellent education to social workers who will go out and work with multiple communities and often with very vulnerable populations. And if we are not including within those educational programs some content on forms of systemic disadvantage, we won't be preparing people well enough. They need to be able to understand the individuals, families, and communities that they work with, and they need to understand how that impacts well-being in order to be effective as social workers in the field.
I think that raises the key question that, you know, somebody like me, I have a doctorate education. If you talk to educators at this moment in our history, everybody is concerned about future enrollments in higher education. Is it worth the investment? Should you, if you have just gotten out of college with a lot of debt, now think about going to graduate school, especially at an institution like Columbia, where you will pay in order to be educated? I think the biggest problem that both of us face in our two schools is, how do we convince people that it is worth the investment? Part of this is also, we're not just interested in anybody. We're not in it for the money. So the idea that we're looking for tuition, there is a certain person, certain type of person, certain group of individuals, maybe that's a better way to put it, that we see as ideal candidates for what it is we do. If we were in a position right now to address those candidates, what would you say is the most important thing that should be a part of their thinking about, yeah, I think I'd like to do graduate work in social work? What would you tell somebody who's having that question? What would you say to them that would convince them that this is a good move to make?
I would say that a social work degree is one of the most versatile degrees that you can get. Somebody once said to me that the MSW and the MPH are the two most versatile degrees offered at Columbia University. I agree with that. It is a pathway into a lot of different disciplines and domains and to very rewarding careers. The people who seek training in social work and public health, to my mind, are change agents. They want to create a different world, a better world, a more just world. They come with a deep level of compassion, and compassion is essential, and it's not enough. You need skills to build on that compassion so that you can affect the change that you want to see in the world. I believe that Columbia provides an excellent basis and foundation to have the skills to create change, not only in clinical social work and practice, which is essential, but also in policy change, in community organizing, and in social enterprise administration and leadership. Many of our grads go on to outstanding careers in social work. You might be surprised to learn that the head of President Biden's Board of Economic Advisors is a Columbia social work grad. You might be surprised to learn that the president of the National Organization of Women is a Columbia social work grad. So if you want to make change, this is where you can start.
Excellent positioning, I think, of who we are, what we do, and why we are necessary. If I can ask you to now focus on all of the priorities that we should be addressing as a nation and as a profession.
Yeah.
Is there one set of issues, questions that you think it's really imperative that we respond to in our different fields? Because since we typically share the same agenda, I'm wondering whether or not the number one priority for you would be the number one priority for somebody like me. What do you think?
I don't know. Now I'm tempted to ask you, Bob, what is the number one priority from where you sit in the public health field?
Well, thank you for asking. I've been very impressed with how many of our institutions at Columbia have been actively embracing an anti-racist agenda as the way in which we think about what we teach, how we teach it, and where we direct people to do the work that we know has to be done. Because I've been around for a long time, this evolution in the thinking of folk like us is something that I see as being really important, but I also see it being severely threatened. Look at what's happened in Florida or in Texas, where folk who do diversity, inclusion, and equity work have been fired. So that what we see as a real priority here in other states is now being declared as against the interest of the citizens of the state. So we would like to have worldwide adaptation, if you will, of the ways in which we think about these things and the ways in which we develop programs for them. But it is not a sentiment that appears to be shared throughout. In Florida, it was the Board of Trustees for the University of Florida that basically said, we're going to shut all this stuff off. So I keep thinking that at some levels, what we see as important and what we know to be a national priority is not a priority that's shared by some of our colleagues who are engaged in graduate education and training. So I'm curious to know whether or not, having cited that as a priority, whether or not in agreeing and maybe seeing other ways of focusing on this, you have some comments that would be useful to share.
Thank you for emphasizing that. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. As you said it, Bob, I went back to your phrase of COVID amnesia. And I believe that there are a lot of folks, especially in the states you just mentioned, who want to believe that racism and bigotry are not issues in this country. They are. They pervade all elements of our society. I don't know of any problem, any serious problem, that can be tackled without acknowledging it and addressing it. This turning away from DEI tells me that people just don't want to see it. I understand why they don't want to see it, but that isn't going to fix it. That's only going to make it worse. So how do we come together to really address this, to recognize how systems work, how it impacts individuals, and how it can get in the way of maximizing well-being and ensuring that everyone can thrive? That's the challenge before us. And I think you're right. It's a really serious challenge, more so now than any time I can remember throughout my career. We need to come together and address these issues. And we need to be listening to each other in order to do that. The notion of banning such training or banning ideas, how is that helpful? I'm just very confused by that whole notion. And I don't understand it. Do you see it as banning ideas? I mean, people use terms like that, and it's very alarming.
Oh, of course it's very alarming, because part of what our two institutions are clear about is how much structural racism produces the challenges that we in social work and we in public health have to address. What I see replacing it in the language of the state of Florida, as well as Texas, is the idea that we are a meritocracy, that DEI programs are basically there to create an advantage for one group as opposed to another. There's a lot of citing of the 14th Amendment, where we basically say as the nation, we can't discriminate. We can't give out goodies based on race, ethnicity, or any other defining characteristic. So there's this notion that by getting rid of DEI, we have now created a level playing field, when in fact, you and I both know that nothing could be further from the truth. So I think the idea is, no, we're about a meritocracy. You're about basically creating another form of discrimination. And if that is the argument that we have to confront, I'm very interested in how you'd confront it. Forgive me, that's a difficult question. It is one that I think we face institutionally, and I'm struggling with it every day, as are you, I know.
Absolutely. Yeah, we are struggling with it every day. I would love to think that we have achieved our aspiration of a level playing field. The problem is that there is overwhelming evidence to the contrary, right? And so we can't say that we have a meritocracy and everything's on an even keel when we have evidence that tells us in so many respects that is not the case. Until we get to the place where we have a truly level playing field, we cannot ignore issues of race and bigotry. It's just not in anyone's interest. It's this notion of reverse discrimination is troubling, because I think it's, again, your COVID amnesia, the sense of blinders on. I don't want to see that's happening. And if I don't acknowledge it, maybe it's not going to be there. We have a responsibility to bring this front and center and ensure that everybody has a fair shot.
I'm going to say something about history, because I think it's useful for this conversation. I was around as a graduate student at Columbia in 1967, when the first real efforts to develop what we now think of as affirmative action programs were being put into place. Folks do not remember, but the Kerner Commission, the report that was impaneled by President Lyndon Johnson to look at the urban violence that had been a part of American life from the 1960s till 1968, was really troubling the nation hugely. The idea then was that we're going to do affirmative action programs because we recognize the historical disadvantage, beginning with slavery, that has put so many communities of color in a position where they can't compete equally, where there can be no meritocracy. So the idea then is that we are making up for history by putting together programs that provide the resources necessary to bring folk who begin behind, not because of something that they did, but are behind literally because of the way social services and social realities are structured in this country. And this is the way we're going to do something about it. When we've forgotten history, we even said that cannot be a foundation for the ways in which we develop programs, policies, or classroom teaching. But you're completely right. If we don't understand history, what's the phrase from Santayana? Those who have not learned the lessons of history will be doomed to repeat them. So I keep wondering, how do we introduce that into a conversation when the average American has so little recollection of history other than what happened after the day they were born, that using historical arguments is really something that is hard for us to do. It's certainly why I think many of us got started at this point. But the conversation has changed. Now that it's all about, no, we're finally at the point where we've achieved meritocracy, we're not trying to resegregate any of the educational programs that we're now starting to change. But we do think that now that we've achieved this meritocracy, history is no longer important. And that's what I worry about most. Using a historical way of saying this is how you make up for the problems that were created in the past is no longer seen as a solution. It's no longer seen as something that we should be doing. And I'm wondering whether or not, in thinking about the future, how much and to what degree the programs we're using to really have our students become well immersed in the issues that social work and public health are confronting, especially in the face of all the things that happened with COVID-19. What do you think about history as a way of helping us put all this in perspective?
When I think of the history lessons I received in high school and what we emphasized and what we did not emphasize, there were huge gaps there. I would like to think that the teaching of high school history is improving over time. We all need to get the full sense of how this has unfolded as the country developed. I want to also go back to this notion of how do we level the playing field? And I think everybody I've spoken to recognizes this, that there are some communities that are vulnerable, that have been pushed to the margins. So we can talk about racial minority communities, ethnic minority communities. You can talk about women and whether they've had a fair shake throughout all of this. You can talk about, as I think about the increasingly diverse enrollment at Columbia College, the proportion of first years now who come from rural communities as opposed to urban communities. I'm thinking about veteran populations that our School of General Studies serves so well. Do we want to ensure the conditions under which each of those groups can thrive when they come here, or do we not? I've never found anyone to disagree with that statement. So how do we do that and recognize each group's trajectory and the intersection of those trajectories that sets people up for success? Our responsibility is to do that, right? Is to set people up for success. That's good for the individual. It's good for the family. It's good for the community. It's good for the country. Again, I've never found anyone to disagree with those statements, that if there are vulnerable populations, we want to support them and help them because that's in everybody's interests. That old phrase, what is it? A rising tide floats all boats. I believe that. And I think that is at the core of social work and public health as well.
We're at a really critical point in American history. We're about to have an election in November. I don't want to comment on anything about partisan politics, but I do think that it is happening at a moment when everyone fears for the democracy that we've spent so much time trying to create. And it's interesting to hear, as a backdrop to these conversations, the idea that we're so divided as a society that one can even imagine we're almost at the point of a civil war. I think that's an exaggeration, but social work is all about literally what is the social fabric that supports individuals as well as groups And if that social fabric is about to be separated, if there are about to be opposing sides, when you think about the future and the future work that social work has to do in the face of a country that's struggling with these kinds of divisions, what do you see as your first priority for this troubling future that I think we're about to endure?
Great point, Bob. Something that we're all concerned about is the divisiveness that we see. I think our challenge in social work and our skill in social work is compassionate listening. I've been to several talks and panels recently that have talked about the apparently very deep divisions between folks in this country. And a questioning of, this is going to sound weird, but bear with me, but a questioning of whether those divisions really are as deep as we think. Are the commonalities there? And if we weighed the commonalities against the differences, what would we actually see? I think there's truth in that. I think what we tend to do is to lean into the differences more, to hook onto them for whatever reason. Your training probably gives you more insight into that than mine would. But I think we lean into that and tend to ignore the commonalities. That's a mistake. I think that social work has to press forward to do the work it's always done, which is to build human connection and to forge relationships where you can find the connections, recognize differences, and remain in community and push the work forward. I really want people to understand that the breadth and depth of social work is much greater than most people realize. And I think it's important for people to understand that, understand that social workers are conducting research and practice to address the most critical issues of our day. Social workers are filling some of the hardest professional roles in our society. They are undercompensated and underappreciated for doing that. And I'm really hopeful that we're going to be able to take hold of that narrative, tell the true story of social work, and gain that understanding. I think it's going to benefit our entire society.
Couldn't agree with you more.
Thank you.
So I knew you as someone who was heavily engaged in research. Now you're at a school of social work, and I know that you're still connected to research, as is that institution. I've served on doctoral dissertation oral defenses for social work students. So I know that in my own history, having done a lot with HIV, some of the best of the HIV-related dissertations I reviewed were those that came out of social work. That was then, this is now. Tell me something about the research that you all are conducting, and tell me about your own take on what you think it means as a kind of an identifying hallmark for what the Columbia School of Social Work is all about.
Thank you, Bob. This is really exciting, and I'm extraordinarily proud of the research that our faculty do. The way they approach research is really very consistent with Columbia University's embrace of what they call the fourth purpose. If you think of the three purposes of a university as being research, education, and service, there's this fourth purpose of being of use to society. How can we take the things that we're doing in the academy and bring those to yield societal benefit? Social research is the, to my mind, the ideal model for fourth purpose type of research. We really focus on relevant questions of the day that address communities in real time. The way my colleagues tackle those problems is in a deeply community engaged way. They look to community members as full partners and to build equitable partnerships, because communities are the ones living the challenges. They understand those challenges the best because of that lived experience. And they have insights into solutions that we can help pursue together. So I'm really proud of the way that we approach that research. I think it's really important to emphasize that. And I'd also like to give you a couple of examples, if I could, of some of the research projects that we're engaged in, because I think it demonstrates that sort of relevance and the ethics that undergird social work research. For one example, one of my colleagues, Dr. Nabila El-Bassel, is pursuing a large-scale study to intervene in the opioid epidemic across New York State with an ambitious goal of reducing opioid overdose and death within a short period of time in strong partnership with communities. There's a great example of fourth purpose research. Another colleague, Dr. Heidi Allen, is working on psychedelic assisted therapy. You may have read about this in the newspaper recently. Psychedelics are showing terrific efficacy in very hard to treat problems like intractable depression, PTSD, end-of-life distress. So we are developing here new training programs for social workers and for nurses to help in administering psychedelic-assisted therapies. Another group in our school with Dr. Chris Weimer and Dr. Jane Wolfhoger are pushing forward with the Poverty Center. Here we have economists and policy experts looking at how specific policies are created and their impact on the ground. Again, that ability of social work to jump between on-the-ground engagement and 30,000-foot engagement enables them to see the actual impact of policies on individuals and families and see which policies work and which policies don't. You probably read along the way about Biden's American Rescue Plan and how it had elements to it that could cut the child poverty rate in half. And it did. And then it was allowed to expire. And guess what happened to the child poverty rate? It doubled. Okay, that's something we can fix if we wanted to. And then one final example I would like to give is the work that Dr. Courtney Cogburn does on virtual reality. And it's a way to, is a technological tool that we could use to achieve greater understanding and empathy for victims of racism and bigotry. I can't think of anything more relevant at this point in time than that. So these are just a handful of examples. I can't name them all because there's too many, but there's so much exciting work going on that I have the real honor and pleasure of being able to support as their dean.
Excellent. This January, the date is January 25th, 125, I turned 80 years old. 125 is a magic number for you all. Why don't you tell our audience what's the significance of that very important, at least for me, three-digit number?
Bob, first of all, happy birthday. It's fantastic. I really, what a pleasure to have worked with you over these 30 years and to celebrate a significant birthday with you. And yes, 125 means something here at the Columbia School of Social Work this year. You mentioned earlier that we were the first school of social work in the nation. That is true. Our founding was in 1898. So we are now 125 years old. Columbia Social Work has therefore been the birthplace of social work education in the United States. Certainly, there were social workers prior to formal education, but this is where social work became professionalized, and we gave pathways for people to enter this profession and provided skills so that they could take use of that compassion that I alluded to earlier. I think that as I look forward, I want to celebrate the accomplishments of the past 125 years, but this is also a moment to take stock. And not to focus so much on the past, but to be forward-looking. What do we want the next 125 years of social work impact to be? I think this is a unique moment and that we should take that pause and really interrogate what our goals and ambitions are in order to really meet that purpose of building a society where all can thrive.
Thanks again for joining us, Dr. Bay. And thanks to everyone for listening to this inaugural episode of What is Happening at Columbia School of Social Work podcast. Join us each month as we chat with students, faculty, and alumni of the Columbia School of Social Work. And be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or whatever you listen to for your favorite podcast. If you'd like more information about Columbia School of Social Work, be sure to visit us online at socialwork.columbia.edu or on Facebook, X, or Instagram, at Columbia SSW. See you next time.